Today's program is brought to you by Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing, taking place on Saturday, June 18th at Nettle Meadow Farm. For more information, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, as usual, Kathy Irway, and we're here at Roberta's, as usual, the home of Heritage. Talking about a trending topic from last week, we saw the FDA trying to redefine a couple words commonly thrown around food packaging. Those words are natural and healthy. In one case, the word healthy was being contested by the maker of Kind bars. They kind of felt that the word healthy was outdated because they were criticized by the FDA for having too much fats in their foods. And they were sort of like, well, what's healthier, whole foods with nuts or more, you know, unnatural foods? And then there's a whole conundrum around the word natural in itself, because it's very sparsely defined just to mean sort of like no artificial ingredients. And then this comes up a lot when makers of foods like Snapple or Natural Valley products have a lot of, they have high fructose corn syrup sometimes. They have other sort of unnatural ingredients, but they're really marketed as natural. And it's a really excellent question right now, as these terms have been defined over the years, how much should they change? And who decides what those changes are? Should it be the guy from Kind Bars, really? I don't know. So my guest today might have some thoughts on that. She is an expert on the Back to the Land movement. She has written a beautiful nonfiction narrative book called We Are as Gods, just published April 26th. And I really, really, really enjoyed this book. Thank you so much for joining us, Kate Delas.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really amazing book. We'll get into that in just a second. But you kind of trace the history of what a lot of these meanings, as we understand them today, mean. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on how do we continue to define, and like what should they mean in your opinion? Is it no artificial stuff, or does it go deeper than that? Should we have certifications like sort of around the word organic, or is that detrimental in some ways to try to do that and put things in a box?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I was just thinking about it while you were explaining the issue today. Mm-hmm. And of course, right away, I always think back to the 70s, which was the huge turning point in American eating, in the cuisine generally, but especially in what we think of as natural food and organic food. And
it was sort of the birthplace of a lot of the businesses that, and you beautifully kind of weaves in some of those stories of the cheesemakers, you know, starting their businesses. And this is also when we had a book a couple years ago on this show called Natural Profits that charted the history of companies like Stonyfield and Celestial Seasoning. So it's kind of like the birth of the marketing of natural almost too.
Yeah, you know, it is. And it depends on how you, certainly the way we experience it today, the 30s was a really interesting moment for that too, sort of like wheat germ and, you know, vitamins. And there was a whole boom. It's an interestingly cyclical boom in American eating of deciding, oh, we're going to go pure, we're going to go natural. And then who runs with it? And then how does it get commercialized after that? So if you think about just really quickly, you know, the turn of the century with, you know, that got us like graham crackers and cereal, if you've ever read that history, that's super interesting. Mm-hmm. And then in the 30s, there's kind of another one. And then in the 70s, what brings us to the issue you're talking about today, this idea of organics, which organic had been, you know, I sort of trace a little history in the book, but about that coming from the 1940s and this idea of compost and
organic material.
Yeah, exactly. And how you would replace industrial fertilizers, which were kind of new at that point because it's a post-war, it's using the waste materials from bomb making and
wow.
Yeah, then that became a fertilizer. And
no kidding.
Yeah. And so the post-war, actually really kind of like, yeah, the post-war organic boom was in response to that. And then in the 70s, you know, I remember reading somewhere that like the people who I write about, the Back to the Landers who came to Vermont, in one case, one of the pioneers, he was saying like he arrived in Vermont and they had like an organic club kind of like left over from the 40s. And it had a mailing list of like 20 people and they got a hold of it. These radicals, I mean, they were Marxist. They were like really, you know, wearing like red stars, like reading the Little Red Book and really politically Marxist, preparing for revolution and seeing themselves as, through food. And they got a hold of these mailing lists from the 40s and they jumped up like to thousands of people instantly. And so I think that's, you know, they didn't invent it, but I think that's really telling that there was this sort of like organic movement coming from post-war that the 70s, when they got a hold of it, just exploded it. And it really hasn't, it, you know, dived down a little bit in the 80s and 90s, but now we're at, you know, the fact that it's ubiquitous, they wouldn't even have thought about that.
This sounds like the Back to the Land movement almost like skips a generation, just it goes along and along.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I was thinking of your book when I saw a few weeks ago in the BBC like news site an article about these English countryside commune dwellers from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, where are they now? What's happening now to this idyllic, you know, livelihood? And all the troubles they went through are very similar to the ones that you describe in your characters in Vermont. And but anyway, so I posted this on my Facebook and was like, should we all just, can we just screw it all and just go live in a commune? And like several of my friends were like, oh my God, yes, let's do that.
you might want to just take some pointers from the book before you just run off.
I'm so glad you did.
I mean, that's part of why I thought, as I was thinking about this earlier, like the reason I wrote this book was because if there had been a book that kind of explored the pros and cons without being either too like, yes, this is the greatest idea ever, no problems, or like, this is the worst idea, it was totally frivolous. Like the writing about the 70s and especially the 60s and 70s and especially the really radical experiments tend to be either like, it was amazing, it was the best time ever, kids today have no idea, or like, they were ridiculous. And I just thought neither of those was very helpful learning from the past.
It's often caricaturized, this Back to the Land movement from the 70s. But you live through this now. So your parents were Back to the Landers.
Yeah.
They went to the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. Very cold place.
Yes, true.
Very, like, kind of rural place. And they tried to make do. And I got to wonder now with, you know, if Trump wins, a lot of people are going to think twice about going back to the land.
I wonder. I mean, the reason my parents did it, and one of the things that was surprising to me was how much they felt at the time like they were just running
from
less that they had a plan like here's how we're gonna go live in the countryside, and more like, oh my God, we got to get out of here, and that there was some sort of like
Walden Pond
exactly. I mean, you know, I went to the woods because I wanted to live deliberately, you know. There was definitely that element of like wanting to live deliberately, and it just seems to me there's something really elemental about wanting to put your hands in the dirt, or like put your hands in like bread dough, or like, you know, get a hammer and some wood and like build a house. And I know that for my parents, they've both said really explicitly that was very grounding for them. And in a time in 1968, specifically for them, when they just weren't sure what was happening in the world, the idea of, you know, building and growing and making something made them feel calm. And that was true of a lot of people that I write about.
Yeah. Let's talk about this cast of characters. You really bring to life a lot of the, you know, not just the character-esque, you know, I guess sometimes, you know, the broad strokes of their ideals, but really like the interior hopes and dreams of these characters that are beautifully collected throughout your, I want to say it's almost like a novel, but it's a nonfiction.
That's such a compliment. That was my goal. I wanted people who wouldn't normally pick up a book that included, you know, 4 pages about the history of organic farming or hippies, you know. Yeah, I really wanted it to be appealing to different readers for different reasons.
Right.
Like even if you weren't interested in the topic, you might just think, oh, here's this woman who, you know, wants something different from her life. Let's watch and see what happens to her as she goes along. So that's a huge compliment. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So, so speaking of one character, Lorraine, in this book, central figure, do you want to read the little excerpt from her very early on, talking, reminiscing about food.
Yeah, so this is Lorraine, who is herself maybe like 20, I think, when this takes place. And this is 1969. She's in Boston. The Hare Krishnas were offering free meals you could share even if you didn't feel like joining in the chanting. Macrobiotic curries with brown rice and strange salty sea vegetables. Lorraine had never tasted curry before, but the blonde women stirring the big pots in their long pastel saris were patient with her questions. One day at the cafe where Lorraine worked, the girl who made the soup called in sick, and Lorraine offered to do it even though she had no cooking experience. Lorraine's mother had hated kitchen work, but felt strongly that it was the mother's duty alone to prepare the family's meals. She had never let Lorraine graduate past opening cans of asparagus or scooping dollops of mayonnaise onto iceberg lettuce. Lorraine had learned to satisfy her curiosity by checking cookbooks out of the library to read for pleasure. The soup she invented at the cafe was delicious. Just like that, she became a cook.
I can't even imagine what a can of asparagus is like. But it's so funny how like radically they decided to break from their parents. Mm-hmm. A lot of it. I mean, how much of human motivation is out of like angst for what their parents did.
I know. I mean, I have to say that, you know, I've said this to a couple of people, but you know, this book is not a love letter to the parenting of the 1950s. Like, there was something that made, the young people at this time just, they wanted, and I should say not everybody, but to a degree that certainly the people who went back to the land, a huge portion of it was anything that looked like the Eisenhower era, uh-huh. Anything that looked like the suburbs, they wanted no part of. And for example, I was, even as a kid, thought it was pretty funny that, I grew up again in northern Vermont in this hayfield, geodesic dome house at the top of a hayfield, and the field in front of our house, my mom always referred to it as a field, but, you know, we treated it like a lawn, and my dad mowed it with a lawnmower, and we were never allowed to call it a lawn. My dad was, like, ferocious. He was like, it's not a lawn, it's a field. And I never quite understood why that mattered to him until I started really looking into this and was like, oh, okay, you know, why does it matter to have a house that's round? Like, why does it matter to have, all these little details that to them read suburbia? You know, they really were serious about wiping out. And the thing that to me is really interesting is when you work from that rebellion mode, mm-hmm. you know, they were surprised at how much they didn't rebel against that. You know, there's a scene sort of later in the book where Lorraine, who moves to, helps found this hippie commune on nothing, just on a bare field, and they build it up from absolutely nothing with their bare hands. And then she gets to a certain point and realizes, oh my God, we didn't actually, even though we rejected the nuclear family, we rejected plumbing, electricity, all this stuff, we have these patterns of interacting with each other that we brought with us from our own families that are continuing to be problems for us. And that by stepping away from the kind of trappings of that, you don't realize how much you've internalized and you brought with you. It was really interesting.
So I guess, you write very tenderly about this generation now, but I'm curious before that, and even maybe now, how do you feel about this generation? How do you feel about your parents' kinks, like quirks and everything? And
I mean,
did you hate it?
I went through a phase after college where I was like, I'm not eating hippie peanut butter anymore, and I'm not eating brown rice.
Peanut butter.
I was like,
what about the sea vegetable curry?
Well, I didn't. Yes, that's true. I put a lot more salt in my food than my mom did when we were growing up. I think I went through a phase of being of sort of rebelling against that, and I definitely know that I have never and will never wear tie dye. And I can't, I see Birkenstocks in fashion now, and I'm like, I can't do it. Sorry, it's just when I have to sit out. And so I think I have those kind of like little mini rebellions. But
you don't live in a little hut or something.
No, I don't. I live in Brooklyn. You know, mm-hmm. I do have a garden, which I have had a garden the whole time I've lived in Brooklyn because I made it my business to join a community garden, and that was really that was a moment where I realized I could live in New York was when I could grow food, and I hadn't quite realized that. Like that, I think that's why I'm so sympathetic to that elemental, like putting your hands in the dirt as part of feeling comfortable, and so. You know, there's ways I have, and my parents can't understand why I live in Brooklyn when I could live where I grew up, which is incredibly beautiful. But I like walking out on the street and seeing people. I really do. It's thrilling to me every day.
And, you know, it's great that you can forge, you can make it, you know, you can have your community garden. You can have those senses of the things that you want to take from growing up and still do it here. Can we talk a second about Bernie Sanders?
Yes, please, let's.
He walks through this book a little bit. Obviously, we know that he's from Brooklyn, but he moved to Vermont in the 70s, was fascinated by, I guess, the land, the culture, the values there. So he visited this commune, Myrtle Hill, a few times. Is that correct?
I think he did visit a few times. There's only, in the book, there's only one scene where he visits, but it's pretty memorable. So Lorraine, the main character, had just given birth at the commune, and her first child was born in a hospital, and her second child was born there at the commune in, this kind of, there's a couple home births in the book, and the first one is really, really idyllic. And everybody who was there described it the same way, as just kind of being this magical communal birth experience that people had. And so Bernie, who was in the counterculture networks, he had arrived in Vermont, I think maybe either 1 or 2 years before, and himself was renovating a sugar house into a house, which was very typical of the move that people made at the time.
That's for maple syrup, right? Sugar house.
Sugar house is, yes, the building where you boil your sap into syrup. And he pretty quickly moved to Burlington and got into politics quite quickly. Because he knew about this, he was in the counterculture network, he heard that Lorraine had these two different kinds of births, birth experiences, and he wanted to write about that. And so he came to interview her. And what's amazing is Lorraine had been telling me, oh, I have a copy of that article somewhere. But because Bernie suddenly burst onto the national scene, like as I was, writing this book. Mother Jones did a huge feature on him, and somebody found the article and posted it online. And so one of the sources for me, the timing was great, one of the sources for me for the scene in the book was written by Bernie Sanders in his interview of Lorraine,
amazing,
which was lovely.
Wow.
And then the other, sort of thing that happened was Bernie, as Lorraine would say, Bernie is Bernie. He's always been Bernie. And he just was interested in, at the time, he really was pressing the people at Myrtle Hill to get involved politically and to reach out to their community and not stay isolated and really be involved and go out and talk to people and see what they needed and see how they could be of service. I mean, he was doing that, from day one in Vermont. And so many of that appealed to many of the people at the commune. However, they had also just been through this horrible winter and had almost died the winter before. And so they needed to get a certain amount of building done that summer. Oh. And so one of the other leaders of the commune, Craig, they had just instituted a 3-day policy of visitors, because basically to protect themselves from crazy people coming through. And so Craig asked Bernie after 3 days, was like, Bernie, I'm sorry, you've been talking about politics for 3 days and we actually have to build something. And so they asked him to leave. And that little tidbit in the book got picked up by conservative blogs a couple of weeks ago. And they were all like, Bernie Sanders kicked off of hippie commune.
What? Well, no, that's really interesting, though, that when you have to build everything from scratch, you're pretty stretched thin for community engagement.
Yeah.
That must have been frustrating for Bernie.
he found people who agreed with him, and they really supported him. They supported him as in his political, including Craig himself, who the guy who asked him to leave, who really only asked him to leave because it had been 3 days, and they were like, come on, the summer's short, we got to build some stuff. And even Craig, campaigned for him later on. So Bernie's support came from that Back to the Land, those numbers of people.
It wasn't a falling out then.
No, not at
all. So we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, but so many more interesting segments of the legacy from these people that we'll talk about right when we're back.
Nettle Meadow Farm Cheese and Spirits Pairing is a celebration of good food and beverages in the newly restored Barn Loft event venue at Nettle Meadow Farm in Thurman, New York. On Saturday, June 18th, come sample and savor, then buy your favorite cheeses and beverages to take home. Nettle Meadow cheeses have been praised highly in national media and have won prestigious awards from the American Cheese Society. Taste samples of goat and sheep cheeses paired with an array of local regional wines, beers, and ciders. You'll never forget your first sample of rich, creamy Kunik, Nettle Meadow's trademark cheese. In Esquire, our very own Ann Saxelby said, "Kunik, it may very well be the sexiest cheese in the USA." Nettle Meadow Farm is a goat and sheep dairy and cheese company in Thurman, New York, just below Crane Mountain in the Adirondacks, between Gore Mountain, North Creek, and Warrensburg. It's owned and operated by Lorraine Limbiase and Sheila Flanagan. Both have a great love of animals, artisan cheese, and the unique challenges of farm life. Nettle Meadow Farm was originally founded in 1990, and it's the home of over 300 goats, dozens of sheep, and a variety of farm sanctuary animals. Again, the cheese and spirits pairing is Saturday, June 18th. For more information and tickets, visit NettleMeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com. That's N-E-T-T-L-E, MeadowCheeseAndSpirits.com.
All right, that was a note from our sponsor, and I got to say that was kind of a very apt one to talk about today. I'm speaking today with Kate Dalaws, the author of We Are Gods, Back to the Land in the 1970s, and The Quest for a New America. Really, really beautiful book. So we were talking a little bit before we got on air about how much lasting legacy this generation of Back to the Landers from the 70s have had on food brands. One of them that you talk about a lot is cheese and cheese making and the rise of the American artisanal European style cheeses really happened during this time.
Yeah.
And one of the characters got into that, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think one of the things that's been so interesting about learning so much about this time period is that I think we're really only now just starting to truly understand what the legacy is. But one of the most direct ways we can see it is on domestic cheese, you know, and this idea that...
Yeah, did goat cheese really exist in this country before?
Well, or like, I'm sure someone listening will know more precisely, but the history that... The way I've read the history from reading kind of big histories of American food is that, of course, it existed, but it wasn't a common... sort of the entryway into the American mainstream diet was through Chez Panisse and Alice Waters, and that she sort of in that 80s moment when it became a hot ingredient, that was sort of when that, you know, as a fashionable ingredient, she is at least one of the big entry points, and that her her chef came from Back to the Land goat farmers who had begun in the, you know, I think this is more, we're talking about like the early 80s when they begin to produce enough that it could, you know, have a widely felt impact. But they started, many of them, in the 70s, or at least they got their goats in the 70s. And so one of the characters...
It takes a while to start, you know, a cheese-making, you know, venture.
Well, that's what I was noticing. The other day, I kind of tried to do just the most informal roundup of all the cheeses I could think of where I could identify that the producers at least came from this late 60s, early 70s impulse, this radical impulse to sort of put yourself into the woods or to the fields or to a farm and then figure out what you were doing. And the goats were like the hot animal in the 70s for Back to the Landers. for a bunch of reasons. My mom was just talking about this. We did not actually own goats, but, they, you know, for how much they eat, they give you a lot, you know, the amount of milk you get for how much a goat is eating is sort of a,
aren't they very docile too?
And they're just, I mean, they're kind super of, smart. They're kind of, they're kind of like, they're
easy.
Kind of badasses. Like they're like a little bit of like, they're rebels. They're sort of renegades. I mean, I think that I, there's a really great food historian named Warren Belasco, and I wish I had in front of him. He has this great description of what appealed to the 70s Back to the Landers about goats, and it's this awesome, you know, they're kind of like wily and smart, and you know, they'll survive off of scraps, but then they give you all of this amazing creamy milk that that people's parents
maybe
didn't like.
People saw something of themselves in these crazy looking goats.
I think they did. And, I mean, goats are there's a huge, certainly baby goats, there's like a tremendous appeal. But you could keep a goat, you know, you could a goat was a good learning curve for learning how to milk and learning how to keep an animal that would give you quite a lot in exchange, as opposed to a cow maybe felt like more of a commitment.
Yeah.
But so anyway, so people had goats and they were, you know, had goats. And once you have a milking animal, you have a lot of milk. And so there's a one of the characters in my book was not at the free love hippie commune with Lorraine, but there's a second commune that I write about. This kind of a semi commune, they would have put it, which was two monogamous couples who were in a sort of co-farming venture, and they, you know, exactly this. They sort of decided, oh, we're gonna become farmers. We're gonna live off the land, and they just bought a ton of animals really quickly, and then had not only a lot of work to do, which more work than they quite realized in advance
for
was going to be. Yeah, exactly. But they had all this milk, and so Peg, who's one of the two women at the commune, she was really interested in cheese and in cheese making and in owning goats, and she'd lived in Spain as an exchange student in college and sort of seen how subsistence farmers there in the place that she lived had goats and goat milk as a really essential part of their diet, and it really, really, really appealed to her. And so she got goats, and she has said a couple of times she got the Nubian goats, which have these long, if you see them, they have like long, beautiful, silky ears. They're just gorgeous. Aww. And she was like, they're not the best milkers, but I loved them, and I loved them aesthetically, and that's why I got them. And so she, you know, immediately was overwhelmed with the amount of milk. They also had a Jersey cow, which gave, you know, amazing, delicious, creamy milk, but too much milk for four people, adults to drink. And so she found herself in the position that people who've had milking animals for a long time find themselves, where they have to preserve it. Otherwise, it's going to go bad. So she really quickly learned how to make cheese in order to not waste the milk. I mean, she would be the first to admit she could, you know, there was more than one person could keep up with. So they didn't preserve it all. But
Milk beauty bath. Sorry.
Right, maybe she did. I don't know. I could ask her. But she, you know, they made yogurt, they made cheese, they made all different kinds of cheeses. And for her, that learning curve, you know, she learned something every time, and she got to the point where she thought she was making hard cheeses. She was making chèvre, but she was making hard cheeses, and she just realized she didn't have enough, she didn't have enough control over the environment. She didn't really have a cave, and so she couldn't control which bacteria were getting in the cheese. She couldn't control moisture. She was aging them on a step on the cellar stairs, like a specific step, and it just wasn't enough control. So what I thought was really interesting is that, you know, in her case, she hit that point where she thought, well, if I'm going to be a serious cheesemaker, I got to invest in like a cave. I got to invest in, you know, the means to have more control over my cheese. And she chose not to, but other people all over the country at the same time who had the same impulse as her, they did decide to do that. And so she was friends, for example, with the people at Vermont Butter and Cheese who were kind of doing the same experimentation at the same time and then decided to take it to that next step and really be serious about it as a business. So to me, that's a really interesting moment, that this experimentation being done by a lot of people for a few people became a business. They just decided that the experiment was for real and they were going to stick with it.
I love it. And I love how this story is so emblematic of a very different way of thinking, or is it like it started with this passion or ideals, not really sure where we're going with that, but you know, like buying this Nubian goats just because you feel like it, not as like a practical business investment. And then that translating that dream into a viable business, I think, is really interesting. Whereas we see a lot of times now in the startup world, you know, people starting with, what's going to work? Okay, let me crank some numbers here, run some big data, and then let's you know, go from there.
Yeah, I think you just nailed exactly the difference, the generational difference you know, I feel less qualified to talk about what's happening now because I haven't looked as closely at the Back to the Land experiments that are happening now as I did at the 70s. But to me, you know, if I was going to just characterize it, what was so striking and interesting to me was the extent to which this sort of late 60s generation, you know, two things. One, they were really apocalyptic. I hadn't quite realized how dire they felt the situation was. They just felt like that there was going to be revolution or there was going to be an apocalypse.
To take it upon themselves to do something so drastic. And
absolutely. So I think that they had, you know, it was Vietnam. Absolutely. It was part of it for that was 100% part of it.
Yeah.
But I think to an extent that I'm not even sure everyone I've talked to recognized how much atomic fear, you know, this is the generation that grew up jumping under their desks for the atomic bomb. And a couple people said, remember, a couple Back to the Landers had this moment where adults were telling them, okay, get under your desk and it's going to that's, you know, you'll be fine from the atomic bomb. And they just were like, obviously, that's not true. So you've told me two things. One, I'm not going to survive the atomic bomb. And two, adults, you're not trustworthy. You've just told me how I'm going to save myself, and you're obviously wrong. And that translated for them into, I have to say, A, I'm just going to die, and B, if I'm going to save myself, I have to save myself. And so I just found that to be so interesting, that kind of like dual like optimism and pessimism at the same time, right, like in this really intense tension. And then the other thing that needs to be said is we're talking about very privileged people. We're and I mean that in the 2016 use of the mm-hmm. word privilege in all its ways. It's people who almost all have, the Back to the Land movement of this time was very white, very middle class, almost all
suburban, you know, escapees,
educated, and mm-hmm. or at least if they hadn't actually gone to college, it was almost all people on a college trajectory. Again, not 100%, but mm-hmm. really a lot. And to me, when I started looking at that, that helped me actually also understand that it was people who felt like they could take this risk because they could always, you know, like my dad, I remember saying that he knew. He decided not to take over his family's dry cleaning business in Boston. But when he decided not to take it over because he wanted an academic career instead, his father sold it. And so he knew that he could see his parents were comfortable. He wasn't going to need to take care of them. He might get an inheritance someday. And that gave him the confidence. And he didn't have, it wasn't exactly like a trust fund situation, mm-hmm. but it was a confidence. Like, mm-hmm. we'll be okay. I can take this step of building a geodesic dome on a hill in Vermont. And if it goes really wrong, we're not going to be destitute.
Right.
We have our education. We can fall back on it. All we have to do is go back to the city and we'll be okay. And so that those two things, this pessimism of like thinking the world's going to end and this kind of confidence, this generational mm-hmm. confidence that like, and they were, you know, turns out they were right. The people who did go back to the cities generally did step right
generally
back into the middle class. And the kids, and I will say almost all their kids, even ones raised in really austere rural poverty, really, whose childhoods really were spent with many of the trappings of rural poverty, almost all of them ended up, the ones that I've, you know, come into contact with, ended up themselves going back into the middle class and having had a college education because their grandparents stepped in. So that to me was also really interesting, this kind of like fear, but then this, you know, privilege that let them take these risks.
I love that you confront that. Yeah, that like sort of still like that awareness of some sort of power or entitlement even. Mm-hmm. And you're right that, you know, also we didn't even get into it this much, but even though they were surrounded by totally new environments and were making things from scratch, still trappings of sexism came through in these communities. And, so much more to talk about. I just want to throw out there that, some of the things that they created, like the design of houses have come back in vogue these days with the tiny house craze. Also, the design of the Whole Earth catalog by Stuart Brand was something that Steve Jobs said was really influential to him in his design of user interface, I guess. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So the Whole Earth catalog to mm-hmm. me is such an interesting thing. I hadn't quite realized, if listeners have not gone and looked at the Whole Earth catalog, you absolutely should.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Check it out.
And Stuart Brand came out of all kinds of, he himself is completely fascinating, but he had friends who were living in these rural communes kind of in the Southwest, but in other parts of the country as well. And he had this revelation while on an acid trip. That was the whole earth.
The whole earth.
The idea of, haven't we seen the whole earth? And so that was where that word came from. But then he also realized that, like, his friends living on these rural communes needed something like L.L. Bean was his sort of like, you know, they just can know where to find the things, the tools that they need. And so to me, that was, again,
goat milking buckets, I don't know, stuff like that.
Yeah, but again, super interesting. They put themselves in the situation and then they went and amassed mm-hmm. the resources and then figured it out, which I think is, to me, that was like a really interesting generational way to decide that you're just going to like go stick yourself there and then work backwards. And so for him, the Whole Earth catalog was
in like a fit of passion and then figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Or like a way to like, cause you think the apocalypse is coming.
Right.
And so he and his wife developed, this catalog that told people where they could order the things that they might need. And then,
he's kind of a central figure in this whole movement too.
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly his influences, I'm not sure that he himself would identify as a you know, as a figure in the Back to the Land movement, but absolutely the Whole Earth Catalog. Everybody read the Whole Earth Catalog. Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for today, but there's so much to talk about in this wonderfully written book. Kate, I'm so excited to read more from you. I know this is your first book. Congratulations. And I can't wait to hear more. It's just out. It's called We Are Gods. And check out. Can we follow you on your website? Or
yes, I have my website is katedalos.com, KATEDALOZ.com, and I have an author Facebook page also.
Check it out. Thank you so much for joining us again. We look forward to seeing more of you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, you made me feel so good inside.